Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Transitions. I'm your host, Christy Money, and tonight we're going to talk about things to consider and practical implications about having a faith transition while you work for the church, and specifically if you work for a church school, but there can be implications for those in other lines of church employment. I'm hoping to get more people on the podcast to talk about, like, say, being in CES or working in church headquarters, but tonight we're going to talk about BYU. And to help me out with that, I have with me Mike Finley. Mike, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Mike is an associate professor in the Department of Government at UT Austin, and he is the co-director of Innovations for Peace and Development and a Strauss Center Distinguished Scholar. And he works primarily with global study students and does fieldwork in Uganda, South Africa, Malawi, Colombia, DRC, Sudan, and South Sudan. That's quite a resume. You've been all over. Wow.
Yeah, I get a lot of nice opportunities to travel. It's pretty fun.
Yeah. And I had read that you collaborate with the World Bank and USAID, UNICEF, UN Peacebuilding Fund, UN Development Program, the International Aid Transparency Initiative. This is fascinating. And you're also the author of Global Shell Games, right?
Yes.
I watched the video about that. That was really interesting. And you are also the father of four.
Father of four, yes. Mm-hmm. Ages 15 down to 7. One girl and 3 boys.
Oh, fun. So fun. All right. So I'm really glad that you're willing to come on to talk about the experience at BYU when you're having a faith transition, because I imagine there are a lot of listeners here who might find themselves in a similar situation. And, you know, we're here to support you. So can you first tell us a bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in the church. My parents, my mother grew up in the church. My father converted to the church when he was, I believe, about 17 years old. They met at BYU. They raised myself, 2 brothers and a sister in the church. So grew up doing all the normal church things, arranging, baptism onto priesthood, the different offices. Served a mission in Russia in the Ural Mountains in the mid-90s, 95 to 97, and then, came home, got married, and went to 10 or 11 years of school, I guess, and then mm-hmm. off to BYU and to where we are now. So I think, I guess share a lot in common with a number of people who have grown up in the church and spent much of their life in the church. So, I think that's probably from the church perspective. Current family situation, as noted, married with 4 kids, and spent 5 years at BYU. Okay. This would be 2007 to 2012. Worked in the political science department, primarily taught courses on war and peace, to some extent on statistical methods, and international development and some other topics like that. So there for 5 years, and then moved to UT Austin in 2012, where, as you mentioned, I'm in the government department, and if so, starting my 5th year here.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, I love UT Austin. It's such a great place to be.
It's a great place, terrific city. So we mm-hmm. feel pretty fortunate
yeah.
to be here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's where my husband's from. So it is such a small world in Mormondom and alt-Mormondom and post-Mormondom. Yeah.
Exactly. And I should note about my upbringing, I had a great upbringing in the church. I really enjoyed most of, what happened in the church. I had great parents who were very supportive, and I don't say that just to gloss over other things. I mean, they were really open-minded, very supportive, very fortunate, I think, in mm-hmm. that regard. And so I have very few complaints about my upbringing in the church, perhaps other than, just the very limited information, I think, that was presented, and, right. To no fault to parents or grandparents or otherwise. I think these are more structural issues, but overall a pretty positive experience. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And it's nice to hear that your parents were supportive and gave you a great experience growing up. So yeah, I've heard that from a lot of people too, that their issues with the church are very much structural and not related to anything parents did wrong or anything. It's just limited information growing up.
Right.
And okay, so could you say a bit about the work atmosphere at BYU, especially as it relates to the religious dimension?
Sure. The thing I'd begin with is that BYU, in many ways, is a terrific place to work. It's very collegial. The faculty, especially within the department I worked in, were really terrific, very professional, and in many ways was pretty fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think that there's the way that BYU is structured and the way it sits within the church system. Again, the LDS Church is the sponsoring entity, I guess, for Brigham Young University. The way that structure, and so the church leadership comprises the board of trustees, and meet with the leadership of BYU. And so I think the one thing you do see is that at the departmental level at BYU, at least in my own experience, almost all of it was very professional. But as you moved up within BYU and sort of went to the higher leadership within the university, it starts to feel a lot more church-driven, and the issues that people care about at the higher levels within the university feel very much like church issues and less about the professional issues. And so, but 95% of what you do or more is really at your department level, and most of that feels very professional with colleagues who are reasonable, like-minded people. BYU provides incredible research and teaching support, actually, compared to most universities. And if in my own case, I was not researching any church history. so that seems to get a lot of people in trouble, or at least
hot water.
Probably more common is that they just self-censor what they're going to say or what they're going to research. But the ones that go down that road, I think maybe face more difficult issues. But in my case, I spend time researching international development, conflict, violence, issues of war and peace, and so forth. And most of this, I didn't have much of an issue with anyone at BYU. And so, and the last point here, I think, is BYU is deeply committed to its students. Compared to a lot of universities, BYU provides extraordinary resources for its students. They have programs for mentoring, mentored research. Now I forget the name exactly, but anyway, they provide a lot of grants both to individual students, but also to faculty who run centers. Mentoring environment grants, I think, is what they're called. And so I think they're very committed to their students. And I will caveat that and say I think they're committed to most of their students. I'd say that the LGBTQ students, or maybe those who lose faith, or some others, don't get that support, but by and large, to your average student, that it feels like there's a lot of support. On the religious side of things, I think in most cases religion comes in pretty innocuous ways. Like devotionals happen on campus, but they're not required of faculty or students. I never felt any pressure to have to go attend a devotional. I actually did attend frequently, and frankly really enjoyed them, because I think that they got people who were very thoughtful, who had processed both the intellectual side of things as well as, the faith dimensions, and were trying to, share what they had been through and so mm-hmm. forth. Even if they weren't pretty overt about what they were saying, it often seemed clear that, that they had thought through a lot of these issues, and I appreciated that, right? So,
my cousin. Oh, sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
I was thinking of my cousin gave a devotional a few months ago, and yes, it was exactly as you described. She's amazing, and I love them too for the most part. Devotionals, yep.
Yeah, I mean, great. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, a lot of really good ones. There are a few doozies, not gonna lie. But you know, but by and large, they were pretty good. Yeah. And some interesting ones. I mean, they, you know, they would bring in President Monson came at one point, and some of the apostles, and you know, President Monson went off. You know, and I think most people sort of say that he's, you know, struggling potentially with dementia and otherwise. And this might have been like on the front end of this, but you know, he was rambling on all these stories about the Navy that I hadn't heard before, and it was fun. I mean, enjoyable. You know, you got to meet a lot of people. That was nice. There's some quirky things too, right?
Right.
Like, you know, praying at the beginning of most meetings was a little bit unexpected for me. I did not attend BYU as an undergrad. And I remember one of my first department meetings, it was a lunch meeting, and I went in and I sat down, and one of my colleagues was Matt Holland, and who since left and went, he's now the president of UVU, but I sat next to him, and you know, we sat down, and he started opening up all his lunch and getting it ready, and so, you know, I didn't even think about a prayer, so I started getting my stuff out. Except I didn't realize this, he was getting stuff ready, but he didn't actually start eating. In my case, I opened it all up and just started, like, you know, I started eating a bunch of the food. And then, you know, and then the department chair gets up and he's like, all right, we're going to go ahead and say a prayer and bless the food.
Oh, wow.
So, and then I look over and I'm like, oh, Matt opened his stuff up, but he didn't actually eat it. So, you know, but, you know, there's little quirky things like that. But, you know, I wouldn't make too much of any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. There's some more subtle, you know, subtle factors that I think are, you know, kind of interesting and instructive. Every fall, at the beginning of fall semester, there was like a faculty, what would they call it? Like a faculty retreat or orientation at the beginning of each year.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so you go over, I think at the, what's it called, the FAC building. And at the time, I believe it was John Tanner, who was the academic vice president, who honestly, I think was just terrific, but, you know, and he'd get up and others would get up and they would tell these stories about, you know, the founders of BYU and the sacrifice they gave and so forth. And these were pretty inspiring meetings in some ways. And, you know, but as I would reflect on them later, you know, there was also kind of this subtle message of, you know, the people that founded BYU in the first place, like they gave their all and they got nothing in return. And, you know, and maybe the current faculty would do well to, you know, to have that similar kind of mentality, right? That sort of this is consecration to the church as opposed to like a professional job, mm-hmm. in a sense, right? You know,
service.
You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, in many ways, service, right? So almost like you're called to this, right? I mean, at UT Austin, I would never go, like the provost would never stand up at UT Austin and be, you know, you should consecrate yourself mm-hmm. to the state of Texas and actually. Maybe someone in the legislature would say that, but
maybe.
But for the most part, you know, I mean, like it's sort of a very different way of putting that out there, and I think a lot of people appreciate that. I think that there's some real downsides to wrapping those two things up, you know, inside of each other and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, you know, I didn't feel much pressure to weave religion into everything. I think that religious education is different. I think they publicly don't want to claim to be, you know, giving like high school seminary style education. You know, they want to be the intellectuals. But my understanding is, you know, from talking with folks in religious ed is that they're still encouraged, you know, to do things like, you know, make sure that you, you know, don't leave a class without, you know, your students understanding what your testimony is and so forth. And so I think that there, you know, in some areas of BYU, there's a huge emphasis on weaving religion into everything, but I didn't feel much of that at all. So, I mean, there's a few sort of, I guess, anecdotes to, I think, illustrate that for the most part, it felt pretty professional. The religious dimension was not, you know, was not terrible, in the sense that, you know, we're sort of forced to do a lot of things that maybe were uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. And that's so fascinating that you bring up the calling, undertones to orientation, because my father-in-law, who also teaches at UT now, but he taught at BYU for a few years, and he mentioned that exact thing to me, that was in 90, it was either 93 or 96, so it's been 20 years. I guess they're still prepping new faculty for the, well, you're going to be making some sacrifices or consecrating your time, and you know, that's important. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that hasn't changed. Okay.
And I should say, right, like, I mean, at one level, you look at this, and I think from the perspective of a faculty member, you might think, wow, this, you know, good, maybe good to consecrate if you're really into this. You know, on the other hand, maybe this is just a way for the church and the university not to have to pay you as much or something.
He did mention that.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I sort of think about this from the perspective of a lot of people who have transitioned and really wonder what the church is spending its money on. And I don't know. I suppose there's an argument to be made that, you know, maybe the church not spending too much on BYU faculty, especially for people that think that a BYU education is not as valuable as they once thought when they were fully in the church, right? They might actually see this as a good thing, right? That the professors are not working for much money.
So, yeah, I hadn't really thought of it that way, but yeah, it's an interesting point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, other things, just to maybe just one more or two remaining points here.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Being at BYU, so I got to BYU in 2007, and this is about the time that Prop 8 was really ramping up. You know, so I think I saw a lot of this, and there was a lot of discussion, and there were speakers that were brought to campus, like I believe the guy's name is Robbie George from Princeton, a theorist who, you know, very much stood on the side of the church and BYU in terms of, you know, pushing for religious freedom and so forth.
I remember that. Yeah, I was there.
Okay, yeah. This was honestly a really difficult time to be at BYU for me. And I think, I suspect for a lot of other faculty as well, just because, you know, I think that most or many or maybe most of the faculty had a hard time with the church's involvement in Prop 8. And yet the church or the university keep kind of conflating the two, but mm-hmm. you know, they don't allow dissent, I think, from the faculty. And so, you know, and we've seen that dissent has been punished before, most notably in the 90s. But you know, it was really hard to sort of go through that and feel like you couldn't say much publicly about it. And so I think there were lots of, you know, behind the scenes discussions, among faculty and, you know, among sort of colleagues in the discipline, but very little, you know, ability to actually do much about that. And so this was, you know, I mean, the work atmosphere, you know, you ask about the work atmosphere, especially with the religious dimension, this, you know, stuff like this was pretty difficult. And I'll be honest, if I don't know how I would have survived or could have survived the events of last year if I were still there with the November policy and the letter that was written in response to the Supreme Court decision that was, you know, read in all sacrament meetings and you know, whatever, the Priesthood Relief Society, Young Men, Young Women's, like, that would be really tough, I think. And I suspect that a lot of people are really struggling right now with how to reconcile this, especially when they can't really speak publicly about it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, hence this timely episode. I'm really hoping that it helps some people who might be in a similar situation or maybe considering teaching there. So it'll be up to them, whatever they want to do. We just want to help talk them through all the options and perspective and current faculty. 2007, that was a crazy year.
Oh, man, no kidding.
Yeah, I left halfway through 2007. I went straight to New York City. I was pretty done with Provo by that point. It had been 7 years, I think. And yeah, Prop 8 was ramping up, and there was just, it was so charged out there, even in the counseling center. That would have been crazy coming in as a new faculty. Wow.
It was in many ways. Yeah. And I think, and to reiterate, I think that at least a lot of the people I talked to were deeply troubled, but really just were unsure of what could be said or done about it. And so mostly it just meant that, you know, people just moved on in silence and had private beliefs that differed from, you know, whatever was sort of public. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is understandable. I mean, if you've got an income to rely on, and there's not a lot that you can do. But we'll talk about that too. So now let me ask, what are the key dimensions of the faith work balance at BYU, and what sorts of incentives does that create, do you think?
So from my perspective, one of the challenges at BYU, at least again from my perspective, is that faith and work become inseparably connected by construction or by design. And this poses some real challenges, I think, for employees at BYU, and probably beyond the faculty, but I'll speak to my perspective as a faculty member. You know, as you know, most faculty at BYU are members of the church. I don't know what the percentage is. I would hear people say it's something like 95% LDS and 5% not LDS. I'm not sure exactly. But you know, when job advertisements are put out for new faculty members, it's stated very clearly that preference will be given to LDS applicants. Mm-hmm. And you know, for the 5 years I was there and seeing the hiring process was interesting. I mean, because we would get applications from non-LDS applicants, and they were always just kind of sorted to a pile of, you know, we don't even need to read these. We just look at the LDS ones, and the non-LDS ones are really only there if you can't find a suitable LDS person and you have strong enough needs that you can't, like, you know, wait for another year. And so anyway, but basically you end up with a faculty that's so predominantly LDS, and then there's a couple of conditions that are placed on faculty. One of those is temple, you know, having a temple recommend or being temple worthy. My understanding is, based on BYU policies and procedures, that you don't, I think the way it's stated is that it does not say that you have to have a temple recommend, but that you have to be temple worthy. I could be wrong on this, but effectively, if you're LDS and you're temple worthy, then you're going to have a temple recommend, right?
Right.
And so it's maybe written this way to apply to non-LDS faculty, that they just have to be temple worthy, even though they don't, you know, have the temple recommend. Mm-hmm. So there's this requirement, right, to be temple worthy or have the temple recommend. There's a second requirement, which I think is more subtle and probably more contested in terms of the impact it has on faculty, but it's the need to have ecclesiastical endorsement for your position. And so I was at least told by my bishop the years I was there that every year or so he had to complete an ecclesiastical endorsement, which would affect my employment. And so I have a lay leader who is outside of the academy completely and outside of the whole profession completely, who was certifying that I could work at BYU or not. And and frankly, I don't know the implications of what happens if you fail an ecclesiastical endorsement. I don't know that it means that you get fired immediately, but I do know from talking with at least two people that bishops threatened them with a rejection of the ecclesiastical endorsement, and explicitly told them that, you know, they were thinking of not signing it, and knew that that could potentially have implications for their job, right? So,
right.
So this is really tricky if you begin to think about this, right? That you go through a lot of school. For most people, 4 years of undergraduate, and then 5 to 7 years of, say, a PhD program, maybe a master's in between. And so you put in whatever that is, 10, 11, 12 years of education, you take a job, and that job, and then you're evaluated not just on your professional accomplishments or lack thereof, but also on the level of sort of, you know, faith, as at least as certified through, you know, temple worthiness and an ecclesiastical endorsement. So I think this creates some really perverse incentives for people, and in many cases I think this is pretty subtle, in the sense that most people are probably not waking up in the morning saying, oh, you know, I've got to like be a good person because I need to keep my job, right? And I'm going to mm-hmm. keep my job, and you know, only if I do these things. I don't think it's quite like that, but it's really tough to separate these things when you know, when you say want to maybe dissent on something like Prop 8 or the marriage policy, right? That this potentially has implications for, you know, for what could happen in your ecclesiastical endorsement or your, you know, your temple recommend interview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the exclusion policy toward children of gay parents. That's, I've heard it said that, you know, one way to deal with maybe some of the cognitive dissonance in working for the church while you're more progressive is to just say to yourself, well, I mean, anybody can keep a temple recommend, or you know, it's not that hard. But you know, I have thoughts on that as someone who's been through the ringer with that. But how would you respond to that? The idea that, well, just anyone can keep a temple recommend.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the I think at least publicly we talk a lot about the importance of belief in the church and how we should have beliefs in, you know, all the key tenets that are outlined for us. And I think there's something to be said for the power and the importance of belief. But when it comes right down to it, what the church evaluates is not your beliefs, it's your conduct, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the church, I think, is surprisingly open to a variety of different beliefs, so long as your conduct doesn't deviate. Okay. Yeah. So we know, I mean, there's story after story of, you know, transitioning Mormons who could maintain all sorts of beliefs and still get through a temple recommend interview. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, you can finesse your way through this by, you know, talking all around things and in many cases being very open about lack of belief or having different beliefs and still be able to get the recommend. But I think the key point here is that when conduct changes, right, there's observable actions that the church and the university can evaluate, then the consequences can be really, really large, right? Mm-hmm. So to your point, right, I mean, anyone can get a temple recommend, you know, you can figure out ways to get through it all. Yeah, that's probably right. And I think you see a lot of people with a variety of different belief structures. But here's the rub. As soon as you want to act on any of those beliefs, it can become incredibly perilous for people, right?
Yes.
And so you have to be willing to maintain your, you know, heterodox beliefs without becoming too public or acting on those in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what becomes, I think, you know, so difficult. So I could be wrong on this, but my impression is, again, that many and maybe most BYU faculty just disagree with the policy, or I don't know, maybe because of Elder Nelson's comments, it's a doctrine. I don't know. But, you know, I think that they disagree with this, right? But no one speaks out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you see people maintaining their temple worthiness, completely disagreeing. And, you know, if you're too literal or too technical with the definition of sustained leaders, you know, these people are out of step, right? But I think that, you know, they just sort of can't act on this in some ways, right? And if they do act on it, then it becomes a real problem.
Yeah, no, I agree. I have similar thoughts and feelings. And from what I've seen, a particularly tough behavior to comply with, you know, even if you have varied beliefs, is tithing. Like that can be really hard, especially for social justice oriented people who, you know, are very conscientious about, you know, not enabling or, you know, financially supporting any corporation or institution that, you know, that oppresses another. And so, but that's, I mean, that's something you got to do as faculty at BYU. You got to, tithing is one of the temple recommend questions. So I will link to a podcast by Bill Reel on implications of tithing in this episode write up. So if anyone has any thoughts about or is conflicted about that, there are some there's some interesting points about, you know, the history of tithing and things that you could potentially do. And it's a landmine, really. Can be. Because I imagine the bishops probably, they would have a general idea of how much you make, or they could ask that outright, and that could be problematic. But yeah,
I don't know at this point. I mean, I have people tell me that, you know, you can contribute directly to church headquarters by paying online, and that local leaders will never know about it. And, you know, others who sort of, you know, suggest pay at different levels and the bishops won't care, or, you know, but some of the more radical proposals, and I don't say radical in a negative sense, I mean, from the church's perspective, radical proposals like pay all your money to fast offerings as opposed to tithing, or, you know, pay to a different sort, you know, like a different charity or something. Mm-hmm. I think you'd have to have a pretty liberal bishop to still sign your, you know, your ecclesiastical endorsement, or continue to give you your temple recommend if you decide to pursue one of those alternate strategies. And so,
totally,
you know, absent that, right, I think you're sort of stuck in this position where you have to, you know, you have to kind of toe the party line in terms of, you know, what's required in terms of tithing or so.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, let's talk about the broader implications of the faith work balance when thinking about church education. What do you think about someone who's considering going into church education?
Yeah, so I think from my perspective, the challenge here is, and some of this we've discussed briefly earlier, the challenge here is that your professional life becomes inseparably tied to your faith, and this creates some strange incentives. And so just to give you, I guess, an anecdote from my own life. So, you know, in graduate school, somewhere around 2005, I believe, is when Bushman published Rough Stone Rolling. Mm-hmm. So I read this right when it first came out. And, you know, as you might imagine, and as you've probably experienced, right?
I
mean,
I did.
You know, this led to a lot of questions, right? I mean, some really serious questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and mostly trying to deal with the cognitive dissonance, live with it somehow. You know, I get a job offer at BYU. I go. You know, everything's always seems fine in your first, you know, in your first little bit. I think you're sort of excited about things, but
the honeymoon phase.
But there's some sort of honeymoon phase, exactly. But in the back of your mind, you're sort of thinking, wow, like, how do I reconcile a lot of this stuff? And, you know, and spending a lot of time and I, you know, sort of dealing with the dissonance and maybe putting things on the shelves or working through things. And, you know, at some point a year or two in, I kind of had this moment of reckoning where I just sort of realized that if I stayed at BYU my whole career, if I don't reconcile all this, it's going to be a really, really tough career, because all my professional and spiritual life are completely connected to each other, and not just in, you know, hunky-dory happy ways. I mean, like, it's connected in the sense that if I go down the road of acting on any of these questions, in a sense, right, that my job is in peril, I guess. And so, you know, so a couple years in, I thought, okay, I'm just going to, like, plunge myself into, you know, the gospel and sort of, like, the simpler version of it, and try to, mm-hmm. you know, try to just sort of forget about a lot of these other problems. And I spent some time trying to do that, right?
And yeah, and you're not alone. A lot of people I've heard do that at BYU, mm-hmm. faculty.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, and, you know, and so, so some of that was like, let's not reconcile it, or let's not deal with the dissonance. Let's just try to go all in, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, right.
And, you know, and that, you know, I think it maybe worked for a little bit. But, you know, it's really tough when, you know, a lot of that material is still sitting up on the shelf, I guess.
And it's so, hard to sustain.
Mm-hmm. It's really hard to sustain, right? And so then it came back to, well, I'm going to spend more time trying to reconcile and, you know, and deal with the dissonance and so forth. You know, and then ultimately, from my perspective, it got to the point where, you know, it was like, you know, I need to have a faith journey that's not connected to my paycheck, right? And whether I stay in the church faithful to the end or walk away completely, from my perspective, I needed to do all that without, you know, any sort of implicit or explicit connection to a paycheck that, you know, fed my family and paid for my home and things like that, right? And so this became, I think it became increasingly evident somewhere around maybe year three or four of employment at BYU that I would be better off, from a spiritual perspective, not being sort of even subtly or implicitly compelled by employment, you know, this employment needs and so forth. And so I recall when we were leaving, my wife, Heather, you know, asked me at one point whether she thought that my testimony would be stronger or weaker after we left. And you know, it's really a tricky question, right? Because I think in some ways I would say it was stronger before we left than it is now, in a sense. But I really can't shake the notion that it was only artificially stronger, in the sense that there was this sort of always a subconscious calculation about having a strong testimony because the job depended on it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to make too much of it, because I don't think faculty are getting up every morning, walking around saying, okay, like, you know, I can't violate the word of wisdom, so I need to keep my job. And I can't speak out because I need to keep my job. I'm not sure they're quite doing that, but I think it's really subtle and subconscious in some ways that these things are connected, and you kind of have to live your life accordingly because of these professional reasons. And so
that's hard. That has to be hard, even subtly and unconsciously. It's I imagine it can wear on you. So why don't more people leave BYU? How does that affect things?
So I guess a few things. One, BYU is a good university. It's a strong university. I think it's considered, you know, there's tiers of universities, Research 1, Research 2, and on down. I think BYU is considered like a solid Research 2 institution. Mm-hmm. Competes well with many universities. Overall, good resources, good colleagues. I think good quality of life. You know, we still travel back to the Wasatch Front and spend every summer there. It's a little hot in Austin anyway, so I think there's that motivation too.
Oh yeah.
But it's a good place, and there's a lot of reasons to stay. And frankly, I think if you look at the composition of the faculty, you'll probably see, and again, I just to be clear, I have no idea what the distribution actually looks like, but I would say that many and probably most employees, faculty at BYU are one of two types. I think that they're either believers that have not investigated the issues. I actually think that's maybe a minority of this larger group. But they're sincere believers, and they maybe haven't investigated, but they're happy where they stand and don't really need to investigate. I think there's a second set that's actually much larger, which is that there's a set of sincere believers who've investigated many of the issues, maybe not all, but many of the issues, and they've figured out a way to live with the dissonance. They figured out a way to reconcile. And it could be a bunch of things, right? It could be that they've had strong spiritual experiences that override, you know, kind of like how much they rely on the intellect. They just know how to process it. You know, it could be that they see a lot of good in the church, humanitarian activities, you know, sort of system of prescribed ethical behavior that's pretty deep, actually, and pretty strong relative to, you know, a lot of other religions and especially a lot of other religious universities. And so I imagine that probably weighs on people. And I think there's people that probably have investigated the issues and are pretty open to the idea that maybe they're not, you know, I mean, even if they have dissenting beliefs, that maybe they're still not right, you know, and they're open to that possibility. And I respect that a lot, right? And so I actually think I think these two groups, right, probably are the majority of faculty at BYU. And so I think a lot of them are not leaving precisely because they believe, right? And they believe mm-hmm. deeply, and it works well for them. I think there's two other groups, though, that are at BYU that maybe, at least two other groups. I'm oversimplifying here. But I'm going to call these two groups the the belief falsifiers, and another group, the self-deceivers. Okay. So I think there's a group of that I would call belief falsifiers, which are, they've investigated the issues. The issues have been deeply troubling, and they probably, and maybe they don't believe anymore. So in a sense, they hold private truths, you know, like for them, you know, they've reached some conclusion. But they're sort of forced to engage in public lies. And I don't want that to sound accusatory or otherwise, but, you know, there's a private and a public dimension. And in a sense, they're kind of having to belief falsify here. You know, you go down the rabbit hole, you lose your belief, but it's really tough to get out because you have so few options, right? And I can talk about in a moment what I think those are. But I think this group is one that we might expect, to your question, right? Like, why do we not see more leaving? This is one of those groups that you should see leaving, right? If you know, if they could get out. And I'll come back to that in a moment. The other one is self-deceivers, okay? Mm-hmm. And what I would define as a self-deceiver is, you know, individuals who have investigated the issues and have found pretty compelling evidence that, you know, that there's some serious problems with the way they've thought about things in the past and the current sort of narrative, and that sort of is unsustainable. But they also realize that they can't continue to go down the rabbit hole because maybe their job depends on it, or, you know, maybe a lot's, you know, there's a lot of investment, you know, because you've sort of raised your family in this or otherwise. And so I think that you have a class of individuals here who self-deceive in the sense that they convince themselves that it's just not going to be worth it to go down the rabbit hole, in a sense. And so you've got to just sort of kind of maybe know about the issues, but not let it overtake, you know, your ability to function and so forth. This is another group that I think you ought to see more of these people try, you know, more of these individuals trying to go, in the sense that they realize that there's probably some issues, but they're kind of stopping themselves from going down the rabbit hole for various kind of, job related reasons. So, mm-hmm. So I think these latter two groups, we ought to see more of them trying to leave. But it's really, really difficult. And, you know, one of the things that I think is hard for people to grasp about the academy is that it's not like any other sort of job market. I mean, in a lot of other areas, say, you know, you go to school, you go get a job at Adobe or Google or somewhere else. You work there for a few years, and if you don't like it, you just, like, you know, you just put out some applications, and there's thousands or tens of thousands of other companies that will, you know, that will hire you, right?
Oh, if only academia were that way.
Only it were that way, you know. I mean, in academia, in any given year, worldwide, there's probably not more than a few dozen, maybe somewhat more than that, but not more than a few dozen positions that that are going to consider you seriously. And that's because you're pushed to, in graduate school, to specialize in pretty incredible ways. And you know, and so then when you go on the job market, there's really just kind of a handful of jobs out there. And so, you know, it's not as simple as, you know, hey, I'm unhappy at BYU, I'm just going to go find a new job, right? I mean, if you want to stay in the academy, it's incredibly, incredibly difficult to do. And so, and this is, honestly, this applies to people at any university, right? So, I mean, you guys probably see this at Georgia, right? I see this at UT Austin. I mean, people mm-hmm. want to go, and it's really difficult to go. So,
yeah.
I think BYU adds some other challenges here, though. You know, because BYU is a religious university and probably the strongest of the religious, you know, kind of the good, sort of the most religious of the good universities out there, you know, nested in a pretty anti-religious discipline or anti-religious profession, the academy, mm-hmm. I think that there's a number of people who just see initial employment at BYU as a strike against you. So I've been told by at least a couple of people that they would never consider a candidate, you know, who had spent time at BYU precisely because they were at this deeply religious institution that was connected to a sponsoring institution that discriminated so openly and publicly against minority communities such as the LGBTQ community, and historically against other racial and ethnic minorities. And so I think, I mean, this is an added hurdle, just that there's going to be individuals out there who are going to struggle to even want to entertain someone that comes out of BYU. Honestly, I think this is going to be the exception as rather than the rule. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that there are key players on, you know, and on job committees and so forth, I think that there is going to be a challenge for many people to be able to move from BYU. BYU also has a strong teaching focus, but the currency in academia is not good teaching. It's strong research. So to the extent people go to BYU and don't emphasize research, I think they do themselves a disservice and make it difficult to be able to move to other places. And frankly, I mean, especially because of the recession, there's a huge glut of newly minted PhDs in almost anyone's given field who are just waiting, you know, or just sort of doing whatever they can to get the positions out there. And so, you know, so for job committees looking at, you know, the newly minted Harvard or Princeton PhD relative to the person who's been at BYU for 10 years, you know, I mean, and frankly, it could be, you know, the person who's been at UT Austin or anywhere else for 10 years. It's just, you know, like the newer candidates, the new crop is just going to look much more attractive, mm-hmm. I guess. So, I think there's a bunch of reasons, right? Like why you see, I mean, there should be these groups, the self-deceivers and the belief falsifiers, who probably should be wanting to move, but I think it becomes really difficult just because of the nature of the academy. And then, you know, maybe some idiosyncratic factors related to BYU itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've heard one faculty member describe it. It's working at BYU is kind of like Hotel California, that you can check out anytime you like, but you could never leave. go on vacation. But anyway.
Exactly.
Trying to add some levity into a pretty serious situation. All right. So, indeed. So to make this, you know, positive, because we want to help people. What should potential candidates for a BYU position consider before they take the job?
So I would say that the first and foremost is that BYU can be a great job for a lot of people, and it may work just fine. A number of my former colleagues are incredibly happy at BYU, and I can see them being incredibly happy into the future. So I guess I don't want to, you know, in some one-sided way suggest that, you know, there's a bunch of problems here and you should, you know, everyone should steer clear of them.
Right. It's not that black and white.
This could work for a lot of people, and it is working for a lot of people, and it could still work for a lot of people. And, you know, and if it can work for you, then great. That's wonderful. So, but I would just, you know, I guess I would encourage people who are thinking about, you know, potentially applying to BYU to think about the long arc of an academic career. Most people, and again, this is not exclusive to BYU, but most people go take a job at a university as a faculty member, and they stay there for the rest of their careers, right? I mean, there's some mobility, but I think I was reading in the Chronicle of Higher Education that even, like, the mobility is even decreasing over the past 5 or 10 years. And so you don't see people moving as often. You're likely, you know, most people are likely to go somewhere and be there for your whole career. And so, so people ought to, you know, think very carefully about, you know, whether they're okay being at an institution that doesn't change very rapidly. In fact, that may be pretty generous to even say that, right? I mean, right. You know, I think it's sort of moving at a glacial pace, right? And, you know, and I think that there's a lot of optimism among some people that they can go in and change the institution. And my experience was, at least sort of seeing, you know, other people trying to change BYU from within, is that there are a lot of really successful efforts at a very, very micro scale. Maybe improving things in your department was possible, but trying to seek improvement that went above the department and up at the university level was really, really, I mean, almost impossible, I think. And so you're going here. I mean, it's a long academic career, and the institution's not going to change a whole lot. And there's some scary thought experiments people, I think, need to do here, right? Like, you know, what if the church becomes more fundamentalist, right?
That's my concern. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and not in the sense, you know, we're not talking like big love fundamentalism.
No, right? Not polygamy. Mm-mm.
So we're just talking like, more, you know, what if it gets more hard line? I mean, how many more gay exclusion policies can you handle, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, how many can you handle, but maybe even more importantly, how many more do you want to handle, right? Like, I mean, people can probably endure an awful lot, but do you really want to in some ways when it's potentially so very, very damaging to other people? And arguably, and I guess I don't want to be too strong on this point, but arguably by staying at the institution, you know, there's some folks are complicit in some ways and supporting the exclusion policies and so forth. So this is, you know, I mean, these are pretty important issues to weigh ahead of time. And I think maybe some people can look at this and say, I can handle that stuff, you know, or, you know, I think that, you know, as a faculty member, I can be apart from the church's policies and not contributing to those, or, you know, maybe they don't seem as a problem, but I suspect many people will find this, you know, very difficult. And if there is a move towards fundamentalism, then this could be a real challenge.
Mm, yeah, I'm especially worried, given Elder Bednar's track record at BYU Idaho, that from what I've heard, even from pretty believing members, BYU Idaho got pretty fundamentalist. Under his presidency, and you know, when he's prophet, and that'll probably be in 15 years, and since he's really young, it could be for 15 to 20 years, they would be prophet. And the president of the church is the board chair of BYU, right? Am I missing that, or how does that work with the president?
Yeah, as I understand it, I think it's
Board of Trustees, something.
Yes, several members or a couple members of the first presidency, and I think maybe a number of members of the Quorum of the 12, and then a few others comprise the Board of Trustees for the BYU.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I could be wrong, but it's basically that. But yeah, the president of the church is the chair, I think. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the lineup here, you know, from the perspective of people maybe hoping for some progress, it doesn't look good for, you know, the next few in line, and even maybe skipping a couple who could be more hopeful are still Bednar and others who I think that, you know, could push things in a pretty negative direction. So
mm-hmm.
It makes me very worried. So again, some people can live with that. I would not have been able to survive something like that, I don't think. So
mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, definitely. As hard as these thought experiments are, I think very important for anyone who's considering a job. And I know it can especially be tempting in a job market like this in academia, where being Mormon kind of gives you a leg up. Well, I mean, not kind of. It does give you a leg up at BYU, and in other places, you know, it's either neutral or it's negative. And, you know, so even if some people get recruited, right? And so that can be hard to pass it up. And I understand that. And so, you know, we're here to you know, not to judge, but to give you as many thought experiments, ideas, and support as possible, because, you know, this is an important question for, you know, those who are already in it. You know, if you're existing faculty, and you're starting to feel like it's not a good fit, you're maybe transitioning, in your beliefs, how would these faculty keep their options open?
So the advice that actually one of my BYU colleagues gave me, prior to, you know, several years before I was supposed to go up for tenure, was that, I should try to develop a record that could get me tenure at other universities and not BYU. Mm-hmm. And the logic was your tenure decision could go wrong for lots of reasons, and you should just make sure that you have a tenurable file at many universities. And then if it does go wrong at BYU, you've got 5 or 10 other, you know, positions that you could go take, right? And I think this is really smart, but overlooked by a lot of people. So I think a lot of people go and they spend a lot of time asking, like, how can I get tenure, you know, BYU? What do you expect? You know, what do you expect from me? And how do I publish enough or teach well enough or whatever? And I think those are just precisely the wrong questions to be asking.
Interesting.
You should be saying, like, you know, if I'm at BYU, how do I get tenure at, how do I have a record that's tenurable at Duke or Harvard or Berkeley or, you know, University of Kansas or whatever you think here, right? How do I get that record? And then, you know, if I get denied tenure at BYU, even if I want to stay, I have those other options. And then the flip side of that is, what if I don't want to stay, right? If I don't want to stay, I'm going to have a file that is going to be attractive at many other places. So what does that look like? You know, as I mentioned earlier, the currency in the academy here is research and publication. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my advice would be to have the file that's attractive to everyone else. It's, you've got to publish. You know, we often hear publish or perish. Maybe in this case, perish means something a little bit different here. But you've got to publish. And this is not going to be, I don't think this is going to be shocking news to most faculty, although, you know, it's sometimes surprising to me to see how the publication strategies some faculty pursue. You know, if you want to be competitive here, I think you've got to find first-rate, first-tier academic journals and book presses, and you've got to publish in those places early and often. And those are going to be the things that give you the ability to move at least laterally, and maybe even above in some ways. And, you know, in some areas, I think this is, there's some other nuance for some parts of BYU, such as, I think, in religious education, where they, as I understand it, have their own set of journals that they all publish in. And some of these journals, or maybe most of these journals, are not taken seriously by the rest of the academy. So, you know, my understanding is, you know, some religious ed faculty will publish on, say, the Book of Abraham. And the only place that anyone will really sort of deal with this is in-house BYU journals, because by and large, issues surrounding the Book of Abraham are really just kind of, you know, have been discredited and so forth for so long and so convincingly. And so, you know, to the extent that faculty go in and just publish in in-house journals that aren't even considered by the outside academy, you know, if you need to at some point go, you know, try to find a job somewhere else and all you've published is in these in-house journals that no one respects, you're likely never to, you know, have, you know, get it even a close look anywhere in the future. So that's publication. Other issues here is, I think you've got to develop a network. So I think some faculty don't spend a lot of time going to conferences, don't try to network with folks, don't organize conferences and so forth. I think this is, you know, I think this is hugely important to keeping good relations with people outside of BYU, who maybe you co-author with, or maybe who will write you letters, if you need to go back on the job market. And people that may try to recruit you for a job at some point. And so having that network out there, I think, is really important. My perspective is, having talked with a lot of people outside of BYU, is they look at BYU faculty and they say, BYU faculty are never going to leave. They go there for religious reasons. Their families all live on the Wasatch Front. They're never going to leave. So even if we wanted to go hire one of them because they were, you know, particularly good candidates, we're just not even going to try because there's all these reasons why they'll never leave. And so, if you don't develop a network where you can at least signal to people that you're willing to go, then it might become really difficult to ever, you know, to ever even have those possibilities. So in my own case, I was traveling a decent amount to UT Austin to give some talks. I was working closely with a collaborator at the public School of Public Affairs, Kate Weaver, and she invited me down for a series of talks. And when I would come down, she and the other LBJ faculty would always take me to Torchy's Tacos.
Oh, Torchy's. I miss it.
You're going to know well, right? So,
yeah.
And whenever they would take me to the airport to fly me back to Provo, I would jokingly say, when are you going to hire me at UT Austin? Because I want to eat Torchy's Tacos every day.
I don't blame you.
You know, and so I would sort of jokingly say this, and when, you know, when UT ended up recruiting me, it was actually folks in a different department, but I was called up by a couple of folks in the other department, Department of Government, and in the phone call they said, hey, Mike, we have a job open, and we hear you love Torchy's Tacos, so we want to hire you, and we promise you all the Torchy's Tacos you ever want. You know, so
that makes me happy.
But the point here, I think, is that if you don't network and develop these relationships and at least, you know, sort of signal to people that you have some willingness to move, it may be very difficult to have those options to go.
Yeah, you're right. You got to signal.
So I could go on. There's probably other things. Maybe let me just sort of hit them really quickly in the interest of time.
Sure.
Apply for and get grants. BYU does not value external grants at all, and some people get them. I got a lot of external grants when I was there, and the leadership at BYU is pretty much indifferent to this. And my understanding is, unlike most universities, if you bring in external grant funds, the church just gives less money to BYU because you just brought in external money. At most universities, you know, they keep getting the same amount of money and you bring in more money. And so it's really valued. Right. But but there's no there's very little value at BYU to get external grants. But other universities really value this. Right. So if you can bring in external grants, you become much more competitive to go get another job. What else? I mean, obviously be a good teacher. I don't want to say that, you know, being a good teacher won't get you other jobs. But I think that if you want to be maximally attractive to other universities, then I think you've got to do, really strong research. But obviously being a great teacher becomes super important here. So, and then I think there's some smaller issues. Like, I think that people are unwise to write op-eds for the Deseret News, especially on church issues. I think like blogging for like Times and Seasons or writing for Square 2, some of these other outlets make people a little bit too visible, to the point where, you know, if they apply for an outside job, you know, I don't know that any job committee is going to raise these issues as deal breakers, but most likely behind closed doors, people are going to have lots of questions about why they're spending their time writing op-eds for the Deseret News or blogging for Times and Seasons. And so I think people have to be careful about their profile going in and being very selective about what types of interviews they're doing or blogging they're doing and things like that. So you want to be a professor here, you know, not sort of like play professor and dabble in everyone else's discipline and everyone else's church issues. I think you go in and be a solid, contribution to the field that you're in, and, you know, you're likely to have many of these options. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sound advice. Thanks. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm feeling hopeful for my fellow colleagues that are at BYU right now. If they want to move, I do think there's a way. And if they want to stay, like you said, I mean, it's not so black and white if you have a faith transition, you just gotta go. I mean, it's so much more complex than that. And mm-hmm. I'm just
some of my dearest colleagues and friends that are still there, I think, are incredibly thoughtful, well informed of the issues, and even I think in step with most people who have deep and serious concerns about church's policies. And you know, and yet they figure out ways to make it work. And I applaud that in their case. You know, in my case, and I suspect in the case of many others, you know, this is unsustainable. And hopefully for those that find it unsustainable, you know, they'll see some of these outside options and figure out ways to navigate it. Mm-hmm. So that they can be, you know, maximize their happiness in their careers and not have it so inseparably connected to the paycheck.
Exactly. All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for your time. This has been really informative, and I do hope it helps. I think it will.
Wonderful. Thank you, Christy.